All righty. We're going to call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Friday, April 10th. We have, I think, 11 bills on our agenda today. The first one is Senate File 825, the governor's budget bill. So I'm just going to orient us a little bit and then turn the gavel over. The intent is to spend the entire morning on the governor's budget. I will first work on describing the supplemental pieces that are added to the budget. We're going to open it up for public testimony. Then we'll work on amendments, adopting the amendments, including the governor's supplemental proposals. I'll present that, and then we'll take the testimony, and then we'll adopt it afterwards and consider other amendments from members. I have one or two additional as well. The hope is that we can get that done by noon. We would recess at noon for a lunch. I am ordering lunch. That will be for members. That will be on me. Thank you for showing up and dedicating this whole day for this. Then the afternoon, we will have to work through the remaining, I think, 10 bills, and we will just work until we're done. A reminder, I've said this before, but Senate File 825 is the governor's budget bill. It is not the vehicle. We do not need to have everything on here. This is really the governor's proposal. It doesn't, you know, we don't need to load this up with everything that everybody in the world wants. We're going to try to focus on the governor's proposals, and if you need to offer amendments, they will be proper. Just as a heads up, next week we plan on meeting Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday to hear the remaining bills that will be heard. We're hoping to shut down the hearings after Wednesday's hearing and start working on putting the bill together. Orienting members to the packets, you have the second engrossment of the governor's budget bill. We made copies only for members. It is a fairly sizable document, but it has been published online for quite some time. Members have the initial spreadsheet of the governor's budget bill and the proposals. There is one item of note. If you look at the general fund on line 6, it is not the target, but that is a problem, an issue with the TANF piece for the raising the MFIP grant to $100. I was hoping Mr. Albrecht would be here to help me through that one, but that's really why this doesn't come to the governor's 341 target. That's on here, and if we have questions as we work through it, we can get to that. We also have the governor's supplemental budget, a worksheet that indicates which items in the supplemental budget were changed significantly and which are new proposals, and then the change pages for each of those. And we have a Senate Council summary for Senate File 825, which does not include the things, is just for the second engrossment. It does not include the items in the governor's supplemental budget. And then we have, in addition, the Minnesota Department of Health change pages for either changed or new items. So that's what's in members' packets. All of it is available publicly. I do know that the A21 amendment is the amendment that is reflective of the governor's budget, and that was published on Wednesday. Notice was sent out, so hopefully members of the public have had a chance to review those proposals, and that's what we will be working off of today. We do not have the cameras on in this room. I know we have overflow. I apologize for that. The cameras are evidently covering capital investments down in room 15, but we did get them to turn the audio on outside so people can at least listen to what's happening in here. With that,
first chair.
Yes, Senator Fischbach.
Number one, there's
two of those.
One has some yellow pages. Are they the same thing?
They are the same thing.
Okay.
And the yellow pages are new proposals, and the white pages are significantly changed proposals. So as you work through that item.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't matter which one I use.
Well, if you want the yellow pages, those are the new proposals, but it is a copy.
Okay.
Evidently, there was copies made prior to. But they are the same thing. I saw that, too.
And then, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
So we'll be hearing bills Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then when do you feel like we would be rolling out the big thing that everybody puts everything they want on?
When it's ready. We'll start. The plan is to start working on that right away when we're done hearing bills on Wednesday. And we'll have a few days at least of preparation to get that ready, and then we'll roll that out as soon as we can. I'm working with leadership on exactly what the schedules will be for when we need to get things through full finance, whether we need to go to other committees with what we have and how we get it to the floor. And so we have to work on all those schedules, and I'll have to meet whatever deadlines I'm given by leadership. So I'm going to have to work at whatever timeline I get, but we're going to have to finish by Wednesday with hearing bills.
And then, Mr. Chair, so you're thinking the following week would be, you'd hit, because that'd give you like 5 days. You'd have
that's my
Thursday,
hope.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
My hope is I have several days to put that together.
Okay.
But, you know, it is subject to leadership. I will have to have my budget ready, our budget ready, on the timeline I'm given. My hope is that it would be next week.
Thank you.
The following after the, you know, the following week, not next week.
I don't have a calendar either, so I don't know what days. But yes, I understand, Mr. Chair.
Days kind of blend. Any other questions of members? This is this is a lot. I went through things quickly. All right. With that, I'll. You know, one item I didn't mention. We do have the governor's original budget book for members as well that we worked through as we. Heard the initial governor's proposal, and it has been amended with the additional items from the supplemental budget. So that's also in the members' packet.
It is amended.
Staff.
We figured areas.
All right.
Mr. Chair, or Senator Lurie, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have Senate File 825 to present. So this is, as I just described, the governor's budget bill. This bill has been through quite an extensive set of hearings already. I'm going to plan to focus on the supplemental portion of this budget. You know, the governor's main focus in the health and human services area has been on mental health and children. You know, the lion's share of the money in the initial budget with limited resources was focused on the mental health. We did some, the governor proposed some important children's initiatives in the initial budget as well, but then with the subsequent February forecast giving a little bit more breathing room, there was significant additional money put into focusing on children and families. And so that's really the overall overarching goals of what the administration is trying to accomplish. The path that this bill has been through, we did have, just to remind members, we had a full day of presentation on the governor's budget when it was initially introduced, and then we also took 2 days of public testimony in our division. We had a full hearing with all of the language in the HHS policy division. We had a hearing in state and local for the items in the governor's budget that had state and local impacts. We had a hearing in the Commerce Committee for those that had commerce implications. And we brought the entire bill to the Judiciary Committee and went through several items with a judiciary effect. So that's, you know, 7 hearings we've had this bill already. It's been thorough process. I've already oriented members to the packet, and so with that, I think members do have, as I described, the Senate Council summary of 825, and you can kind of work through that to understand what's in there. I'm going to focus my testimony on the 821 amendment, which has that been passed out to members? We should pass the 821 amendment out, and I will step through that really to explain the governor's changes. Most of these have been legislative proposals that have also had hearings throughout the session so far. We'll start with the DHS and the significantly revised proposals. So the first one is child protection oversight. This is, of course, Senate File 4, authored by Senator Sharon. This is the governor's proposal in regards to this, which is in line with Senator Sharon's. Senator Sharon, I believe, has an amendment that goes beyond what the governor is proposing in the supplemental, but we will hear that later on today as well. The governor's proposal recommends additional funding for oversight of the state's child protection system and additional investments to improve child safety and reduce disparities in the child protection system. This funding would support an oversight infrastructure that includes monitoring systems for child maltreatment screenings, child mortality review. It provides guidelines and best practice development and training of child protection workers around intake and screening decisions that happen out in the field. It provides for examinations of child fatalities and near fatalities. All of these are recommendations from the governor's task force on the protection of children. And included in this proposal are funds for additional county staffing to address statutory changes and funding for culturally specific services to help reduce disparities in child welfare for communities of color and American Indian children. In the original governor's proposal, there was 11 positions for the DHS support of this. This governor's addition includes another $25 million per year, $50 million over the biennium, to increase state funding for county coordination of services in child welfare, for county staffing to carry out the additional casework responsibilities as a result of the Child Protection Task Force recommendations, and 10% of the funds awarded are based on outcomes related to the use of best practices. The cost, again, is $44 million for this one, and then also provides funding to community organizations and counties to support the use of evidence-based practices in child welfare to address disparities in the child protection system for children of color and American Indian children. And this is a grant program with $6 million proposed in the 16 and 17 biennium. The second significantly revised proposal is the closure of the CABS facility, the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services in Willmar. This is intended to be combined with the establishment of contracted extended stay hospital psychiatric beds for children and youth in need of intensive services, and the development of the psychiatric residential treatment facilities. The close of this, of the CABS, results in a net state savings of $67,000 in the 16-17 biennium and $2.3 million in the following biennium. There is no Senate proposal that tracks this one. This is a governor's only proposal. The third significantly revised proposal is increased capacity for individuals with complex conditions. This one also, there is no Senate proposal tracking this. It's page 71 of the original budget book, but it's changed. It increases the general fund base for direct care and treatment for the creation of three new state-operated service locations, one in intensive residential treatment services, we know it as ERTS, and two community behavioral health hospitals. And it also requests additional funding to support a staffing model at the existing CBHHs to allow these facilities to more fully utilize their licensed bed capacity. The total cost of this proposal is $8.7 million in 16-17 and $25 million in 18-19. The cost is partially offset by the county share of costs and other dedicated revenue. Also included in this proposal, the governor recommends making some one-time reallocations of a portion of the receipts earned by state-operated intensive residential treatment services and foster care services not currently dedicated to another purpose. $3.2 million is to be transferred to MSOC's enterprise account, and $1 million is to be transferred to the state-operated services mental health budget activity. The next significant revised proposal is transition initiatives flexibility. This one also has no Senate file that coordinates with this. It's a governor's only proposal. It was on page 81 of the original governor's budget. And the changes, now the governor recommends expanding the eligibility for the transition to community initiative to help more people being served in state-operated facilities transition back to the community. What this recommendation does is it expands the eligibility for the 2013 transition to community initiative to expand it to those people age 65 and older receiving services at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center or the Minnesota Security Hospital or the Forensic Nursing Home in St. Peter who no longer require hospital level of care. It also expands eligibility to adults over 65 being served at the CBHH. And the proposal costs $1.6 million in the 16-17 biennium. The last significantly revised proposal is the CCDTF, the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund rate changes. It's on page 93 of the original budget proposal, but it's been changed. This also has no Senate proposal to track it, though Senator Franzen does have a chemical dependency rate increase bill, but it doesn't really track the same way that this one does. This proposal, the governor recommends a change to the rate structure for the CCDTF to provide a new base rate for providers who are state certified in integrated dual diagnosis treatment and meet certain staffing requirements and serving individuals committed to the Commissioner of Human Services who present with complex issues and who may present a risk to public safety. This new rate would apply to either private residential CD treatment providers or the state-operated community addiction recovery enterprise programs, that's the CARE facilities. The governor recommends restructuring the CARE program to reduce bed capacity from 174 beds across six sites today to 70 beds across up to four sites by January 1st of 2017. Effective July 1, 2015, the governor recommends providing a general fund appropriation to sustain the CARE program as the restructuring progresses. So the governor recommends a one-time transfer of unspent funds in the CCDTF for two purposes. $2 million is to be transferred to the CARE enterprise account, and $3.2 million is to be transferred to the state-operated services mental health budget activity. So the proposal would provide a new base rate of $475 per client per day for providers who are state certified in integrated dual diagnosis treatment, meet the staffing requirements, and are serving those individuals I described before. These rates would be implemented January 1st of 2017, and beginning in the proposal is to close the CARE facility in Carlton July 1 of 2015, and sites in Brainerd and St. Peter and Wilmer reduced to 16 beds. Reducing to 16 beds would allow the state to additionally capture federal reimbursements for serving individuals on medical assistance, and the site in Anoka would be reduced from a capacity of 29 to 22 beds, and the proposal is to have the Fergus Falls site closed by January 1st of 2017. That is all of the significantly revised proposals in the governor's supplemental budget. Moving on to the new proposals, those are the yellow pages. Senator Fischbach, if you chose to work through the one with the color-coded, we're moving into the new items. The first one is economic stability for families. This one does have a Senate companion tracking it. Senator Hayden has Senate File 34. If members are trying to track in the A21 amendment, this proposal is on page 5, lines 11 to 19. Effective October October 1, 2015, the governor recommends $68.2 million for the 16-17 biennium to increase the MFIP cash grant by $100 per month. This change would help address growing number of children who are homeless, increase the economic stability of families, and support state efforts to increase school achievement. This proposal is shared between the general fund of $21.175 million and the TANF fund of $47 million. It is related to a Department of Revenue proposal to fund the working family tax credit in the general fund and pick those costs up so that the TANF funds are freed up to provide most of this increase in the cash assistance. We've heard this in Senator Hayden's bill and also a Senator Eaton bill that had even a larger increase. The next one is a Homeless Youth Act funding. We have a Senate tracking on this one as well. It's Senate File 548. Senator Dibble brought this forward. The governor recommends $2 million in additional funding for the 16-17 biennium for grants to nonprofits and tribal governments to provide street outreach, drop-in centers, transitional living programs, and supportive housing for runaway and homeless youth. The current base funding for the Homeless Youth Act is $6.3 million per biennium. This proposal adds another $2 million per biennium to that base funding. In this proposal, one position is included, one FTE, to assist in establishing increased capacity in greater Minnesota and to oversee the monitoring of grants. I know we had a big discussion about trying to make sure that we are able to build that capacity in greater Minnesota when we heard this bill in the Senate, so that was a good step forward, I think. The next new item in the governor's supplemental budget is safe harbor services for sexually exploited youth. This is a cross-agency initiative. This is a new way of having change pages. You'll see up in the upper right-hand corner, it says that it's a cross-agency initiative, so this appears both in the DHS change pages and in the Minnesota Department of Health change pages. The governor recommends an increased appropriation to DHS of $1.6 million in the 16-17 biennium for safe harbor, shelter, and housing to provide services for sexually exploited youth, and also recommends an increased appropriation to the Minnesota Department of Health of $2.4 million in the 16-17 biennium for safe harbor activities. Current base funding is $2 million for MDH and $2 million for DHS and $3 million for MDH. And this additional money is an 80% increase over base for both agencies. So it's $4 million for the biennium for safe harbors. And again, we've heard this from Senator Pappas. The next new item in the governor's budget is reducing incidence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We have Senate Files 948, Senator Franzen brought to us, that tracks this proposal. The governor recommends establishing an ongoing fetal alcohol syndrome spectrum disorder grant program. The governor recommends continuing funding for an FASD program currently operating in Olmsted County. That is the CRAFT program. We did hear about this when Senator Franzen described her bill, and this funding would allow for two additional counties to put together FASD programs similar. The next new item in the governor's supplemental budget is a creation of ABLE accounts. That is Achieving a Better Life Experience. We have Senate File 39. Senator Hoffman brought this before us. The governor recommends funding to establish Achieve a Better Life Experience accounts for people with disabilities. The funding will be used to provide initial administrative resources to implement and maintain ABLE accounts. And this recommendation invests $105,000 from the general fund for 16-17. And beyond that, it is budget neutral and fee supported in the 18-19 biennium and beyond. One difference between Senator Hoffman's proposal and the governor's proposal is Senator Hoffman also includes some marketing that is not marketing of these ABLE accounts to make people with disabilities aware of its existence and encourage the use of this new tool. And the marketing is not in this proposal. So, but we will have that on the table for possible inclusion already. The next new item that the governor is proposing is one that doesn't have a Senate companion. It is a supportive housing pay-for-performance pilot project. If members want to read more about this one, since we haven't heard it before, it's in the 821 amendment, the language. It's on page 9, line 18, through page 11, line 21, and also page 12, line 20, to page 13, line 19. That's where you will find the actual language. What the governor is recommending is a pay-for-performance pilot project to provide targeted supportive housing options for individuals with disabilities or mental illness currently served at the Minnesota State-Operated Community Services, MSOCs, or in adult foster care. This performance payment structure and supportive housing intervention would allow for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities or mental illness to live in community-integrated housing with relatively little financial risk to the state. The state savings would be used to make performance payments to the service provider selected. DHS, along with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, proposed to establish a pay-for-performance pilot project to transition individuals from MSOCs and medical assistance waiver programs to community-integrated supportive housing settings. Upfront capital and administrative support from a third-party service provider would be provide the means to expand the supportive housing infrastructure that is needed before individuals would transition to these less restrictive environments. Because individuals are expected to transition to less expensive housing with supports, the pilot is expected to generate Medicaid savings. And to the extent the state savings are realized from the transition, the state would pay the intervention service provider retrospectively. The pilot project expects to transition people with intellectual or developmental disabilities and people with mental illness to more community-integrated settings over the next 4 years. The pilot proposes to transition 100 people to supportive housing services from adult foster care or MSOC settings phased in over those 4 years. Additional item in the governor's the governor's proposals is another cross-agency initiative. It is employer contributions for permanently disabled employees. We've heard this in Senator Sharon's Senate File 336. If members want to see the actual language on this one, it's in the 821 amendment on page 11, line 22, through page 12, line 19. The governor recommends that DHS and the Department of Corrections continue employer contributions for medical and dental benefits to employees who are totally and permanently disabled as a direct result of an assault by a patient or client. The proposal would provide employer share of health and dental to these employees if they met the following criteria. The individual would have to be a member of the Minnesota State Retirement System, MSRS, or the General Employee Retirement Plan, or MSRS Correctional Employee Retirement Plan, would have had to have worked at a forensic services program or at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, operated by the Commissioner of Human Services, or a Department of Corrections facility, and the individual would have to be determined totally and permanently disabled under laws governing MSRS as a direct result from an assault that occurred during employment. It is estimated that every year, beginning in 2017, one former employee from each agency, DHS and DOC, would become eligible for the insurance benefit continuation established in this proposal. The next additional item is managed care audit requirements. There is no Senate proposal for this one either, but we did hear from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on their findings regarding managed care audits, and they did have some recommendations that have been discussed at the legislature, and the governor has added a piece to address that. The language is in the A21 amendment on page 14, beginning at line 6 and continuing through page 15, line 32. And so the governor recommends increasing oversight and auditing of managed care organizations that contract with the Department of Human Services to provide health care services to MA and Minnesota Care enrollees. The proposal would provide additional funding for staff and a state contractor to conduct ad hoc audits of MCOs under contract with DHS to ensure increased oversight of MCO administrative expenses. The oversight work would include allocation methods of administrative expenses for state public programs, appropriateness of administrative expenses, validation of administrative and medical expenses provided for rate setting purposes, including unallowable costs, unallowable expenses, validation of documentation and contracts to support administrative and medical expenses. And the proposal includes funding for 3.5 FTEs to conduct the audits and implement audit recommendations, and an additional $150,000 for a state contractor that will provide financial and actuarial expertise to assist DHS in conducting these audits. The total cost of the proposal is just shy of $700,000 for the 16-17 biennium. The next item is also new to the governor's supplemental budget. It is establishing the Minnesota Task Force on Healthcare Financing. We do have a similar task force recommendation. It is Senate File 1275, rather, brought forward by Senator Hayden. Members can find the governor's language regarding the task force in the A21 amendment, page 16, line 4, through page 17, line 32. The governor recommends establishing a task force on healthcare financing that will consider future options for coverage and purchasing reforms for the state's public healthcare affordability programs, MA and Minnesota Care, as well as MinSure. These options will include opportunities under federal law for waivers and the health insurance exchange. The proposal has a net cost to the general fund of $500,000 in the 16-17 biennium. So the task force would consider the state's options for coverage and purchasing reforms and provide the governor and the legislature with recommendations based on the analysis of the fiscal impact of the state and the impact these options would have on consumers and their access to health care. The task force would include representatives from the legislature, from the healthcare industry, from counties, from consumers, from community organizations, and representatives from state agencies. In developing these options, the task force would require policy, financial, and actuarial analysis to consider the effect of options and a facilitator to manage the task force and stakeholder process. That's where the $500,000 would come in. The recommendations developed under this proposal would be submitted to the governor and the legislature by January 1st, 2016, so that we could consider those in the next legislative session. And then the last of the DHS new items in the governor's proposal is a nursing facility workforce enhancement. There is not a Senate proposal that tracks this method of investment in our nursing home industry, though Senate File 273 that I have brought forward and had discussions about is moving forward. It's a little different approach, but the governor's approach is described in the A21 amendment on beginning on page 17, line 33, and continuing through the end of page 19. If the recommendation from the governor is a operating payment rate increase for nursing facilities to provide funds to be used entirely for wage increases and associated costs to help nursing facilities compete more successfully in their local labor markets and to hire and retain direct care staff. The proposal invests $25 million in the 16-17 biennium and $35 million in 18 and 19. The proposal allows nursing facilities to request an MA rate increase effective January 1, 2016, for nursing facilities who apply for that rate increase. It requires that 100% of the additional money available from these rate increases be dedicated to providing wage increases and associated costs. It bases the funding level decisions on local labor market conditions. So the applications from nursing facilities need to include information on local or regional wage levels for comparable positions, either in nearby hospitals or other employees that recruit individuals with comparable qualifications. And this information would be used to establish a target wage level for each facility. It directs the Department of Human Services to compute the state share of the cost of all requested rate increases and fund them all fully, if the $25 million appropriation is sufficient to do so. If the appropriation provided is not enough to meet all of their requests, all of the requests would be funded in an equal percentage such that the appropriation has not exceeded the $25 million for the 16-17 biennium. It applies to all staff directly employed by and working in the facility, except staff being paid a base wage of $40 per hour or more. The expectation is that a rate increase of 5%, an average rate increase of 5%, would be experienced. The goal would be so that staffing levels and direct care employee retention improves. Improved staff retention is known to result in improved care for nursing home residents and improved access to nursing facilities. That is the DHS new and revised proposals in the governor's supplemental. Now we'll be moving to the MDH. Minnesota Department of Health proposals. This is a smaller set. The first item in this set, if members are ready, is that cross-agency initiative with the Safe Harbor Services for sexually exploited youth. I covered that in the DHS portion. The next one is a Vulnerable Adults Act and state facility regulation. This is a new proposal from the governor for the Minnesota Department of Health. The governor recommends investing $1.5 million each year from the general fund to maintain existing protections for vulnerable adults in healthcare settings. MDH protects vulnerable adults in settings such as nursing homes, boarding care homes, and supervised living facilities through state licensing and federal certification of the facilities, as well as by investigating complaints under the Vulnerable Adults Act. Complaints under the Act have grown tremendously in recent years. There is a chart that shows that growth in the handout from MDH, and require additional funds to ensure that MDH can continue to investigate all complaints alleging actual harm. This would be the first increase in funding for the Vulnerable Adults Act enforcement in 20 years. The proposal also provides $362,000 for licensing of state-run facilities to ensure continued oversight. Starting in FY16, this proposal provides an additional $1.15 million per year to support the Vulnerable Adults Act enforcement, and $362,000 for the regulation of facilities operated by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Human Services. That's this proposal. This activity is currently covered through special revenue funds, the fee-supported activity, and with its growth, it's no longer able to be accommodated there, and so the governor is recommending we take this on with general fund. The next change item from the Department of Health supplemental proposal is protecting vulnerable adults again in the supplemental nursing service agencies. This is really a technical mistake to balance the fees and the revenue. It doesn't really change the proposal, and it's a technical correction to the initial proposal that came forward that we've already covered. The last item from the Department of Health in the governor's supplemental budget is protection from lead and radon hazards. There were some changes proposed in the governor's supplemental, and further working with the industry to make sure this works well. The radon fees here are reduced. The number of fees collected are reduced by removing supervisors' fees. And what really happened was we consolidated supervisor and technicians, so there's one fee for supervisors or technicians, and it clarifies that people who own their own home and are doing work on their own home do not need to be licensed, and it delays implementation of the proposal. That's the extent of the MDH proposals, and that is the governor's supplemental proposals to be added to the 825 amendment. So I guess just for procedure, what I would like to do is move the 821 amendment. I guess I failed to do that. So I think it'd be fair to take public testimony and take action on my motion probably at the end of the public testimony. And then have members. I can take questions from members now or after testimony. We can take a few now if members have particular questions.
Members have any questions at this point, or should we just move on to public testimony? All right. So we will start with public testimony. First on the list is Ethan Vogel, and I'll call it two at a time so we can get going, because we have a long list of testimony and a long agenda for the day. And second is Ebony Green from Youth Moving Forward, so if both testifiers can come up and get ready to present their testimony. All right, we'll go with number three and four.
Oh, here's Ethan.
Here we go. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Good morning. My name is Ethan Vogel, a legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. As you just heard, the governor's revised budget proposal delays the closure of the CABS facility in Willmar, the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services facility. We are thankful for the governor's that the governor has proposed a more realistic timeline. However, it is unfortunate that DHS continues to mislead the legislature by reporting a low daily census average. The fact remains that DHS placed a cap of 5 patients per day on this facility, and without that cap, the CABS facility would be serving many more children who need their help. CABS is well positioned to fulfill the state's obligation to care for the most challenging patients, an obligation that is not going to go away. We are opposed to the closure of the CABS facility. We are also opposed to the elimination of over 100 addiction recovery beds located across the state in the various care facilities. We do applaud the proposal for increased capacity at the state's direct care and treatment state-operated mental health services facilities. Caring for individuals with the most complex health conditions is an important obligation, another obligation that isn't going to be going away. The state needs to do a better job of serving patients in the right setting, and this proposal is a step in the right direction. We also support the funding that's been proposed to pay for the employer share of the health and dental benefits for injured state employees. That's an important obligation as well. And we also support the work of the governor's task force on child protective services. And it's a very promising, and it's reflected in his budget proposal as well. With that, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Ms. Green, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ebony Green, and I'm here representing Youth Moving Forward, a statewide coalition of homeless youth providers. We would like to thank Governor Dayton for his inclusion of an additional $1 million per year to the Homeless Youth Act. I became homeless when I was 16 years old. Due to conflict between my mother's then controlling and abusive boyfriend and I, my mother made the decision that one of us had to leave, and unfortunately, she decided that I was the one that had to leave. I was also in fear of my personal safety. While homeless, I couch hopped for about a year while still going to school, sometimes relying on places where I feared for my safety as a young woman and environments that I would not have otherwise chosen. Finally, I was accepted into RESIC, a youth transitional housing program through Lutheran Social Services. Through the program, I was provided with my own studio unit apartment as well as supportive case management services and supportive adult connections. The stability and support I received from RESIC allowed me to focus my attention on completing high school while often working two jobs as well as preparing to go on to college. Today, I am grateful that I was able to transition out of youth homelessness to become a self-sufficient adult. I currently hold a Bachelor of Science degree from Howard University, and I am 2 months away from completing my Master of Social Work degree while working as a case manager in Hennepin County. My future plans also include running for political office someday. If it wasn't for the help that I received, I don't know where I'd be today. With that said, I hope that you will also support an increase of funding for the Homeless Youth Act, which will allow for more youth experiencing homelessness throughout the state to have the opportunity for success that I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Green, for sharing your story. Congratulations, and it's great to hear more women thinking of running for office, so we should park that and talk about that later. Senator Sharon?
I want to congratulate you as well, Ebony, for a characteristic that you have that's hard to develop, and that is persistence and commitment. So I really congratulate you. Although, unlike Senator Franson, I was really with you, thought this is a person that has developed amazingly good judgment and persistence until I heard you say that you were considering running for public office.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Lori?
We can move on with
sure.
The testifiers, but I should note, you know, if testifiers are out in the hall, make themselves known to the sergeants, because we're not supposed to allow people to stand in here, and there are a lot of people. So if testifiers are out in the hall listening, make yourself known to the sergeants, and we will make sure that people make it in and have the opportunity to offer their testimony. That's why we had the delay on the first one. So.
And we're following the agenda, so hopefully they have that outside as well. So the next up is Shalone Wilson from Wilder Foundation and Deb Schulstrom from Otter Tail County Human Services. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Shalone Wilson, and I work for the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. And the Wilder Foundation is a nonprofit community organization that helps children, families, and older adults in the greater St. Paul region through direct services, research, leadership development, and community building. So I'm here today on behalf of the families and communities Wilder serves, as well as the employees of Wilder, to strongly urge you guys to support the governor's decision to increase the funding to build on the foundation of Minnesota's mental health system. These funds will go a long way to fill gaps in services and will help ensure that people get appropriate and timely care. I'd also like to express appreciation to the governor for including funding in the budget for the Homeless Youth Act. This will assist youth experiencing homelessness to transition to successful adulthood and avoid repeated episodes of homelessness late in life. Every dollar invested in supportive housing returns $1.44 and lowers costly expenses to jails, emergency rooms, shelters, and detox facilities. It is our hope that you all will also recognize the impact of this funding and choose to support the Homeless Youth Act. Lastly, I'd like to highlight the governor's decision to support an increase to the cash assistance for families on the Minnesota Families Investment Program. This will help bring Minnesota families and children living in deep, deep poverty one step closer to reaching financial stability and help break the cycle of poverty amongst families in the state of Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, members, I urge you all to support not only the governor's decisions, but the decisions by the communities and thousands of citizens of Minnesota who are striving towards better health and well-being and stability. So once again, thank you to the governor, Madam Chair, and members for this time. I, too, have been a homeless youth. I have, too, come from a family that experienced continuous cycles of poverty and know how much this funding how far this funding goes. And by you all supporting these investments, they will no doubt have a lasting impact on Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson for your testimony, for sharing your story as well. Ms. Shulstrom?
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Deb Shulstrom, and I'm with Ottawa County Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning regarding the Consolidated Treatment Dependency, the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund rate change, and the reduction of the care facility beds. Ottertail County, as well as counties statewide, has concerns with the proposal to downsize the state's inpatient chemical dependency treatment beds in a fashion that's too short to allow for adequate services to be in place to meet the needs of people who are hard to serve. Currently, people on judicial holds, commitments, and stays of commitments are waiting for beds to be available to receive inpatient treatment. Many will wait in detox facilities, behavioral health hospitals, emergency rooms, and so on for a bed to be available. Given the difficulty in accessing treatment beds today, it would be irresponsible to downsize the state's capacity prior to having treatment providers in place with the capacity to serve these individuals. The governor's supplemental budget, as you heard, proposes to downsize the state's bed capacity from 174 beds to 70 beds no later than January 1st of 2017. In the next year and a half, in order to meet the criteria in the proposal, there would need to be a new rate established and approved, policies and procedures developed for state certification of integrated dual diagnosis treatment, and policies and procedures regarding the staffing ratios for persons that will meet the criteria of IDDT complex. Once completed and in place, then providers can assess their true ability to meet the criteria to deliver the service that is needed. Additionally, Ottawa County has a financial interest in the facility located in Fergus Falls. The facility was built at the request of the state in order to provide a 60-bed care facility in Ottawa County. The state entered into a joint powers agreement and a 20-year sublease with an option to renew for 10 additional years. DHS Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry has acknowledged the commitment on the part of the state to the county and the length of the lease. In a meeting last week in Ottawa County with our commissioners, our administrator and directors, she informed us, she indicated that had the state been aware of the length of the lease, they may not have made the recommendation that they made regarding the care facilities and may have looked to do something different with that proposal. Ottawa County is currently working with the Department of Human Services to look at options for the facility, which could include a 16-bed care facility continuing to be there. Ottawa County, with the support of county statewide, requests that you support reversing the service capacity reduction, or at the very least slowing that process down so that it will allow more time for private providers to have services in place to meet the needs of those currently served by these programs, and that that day be no earlier than January 1st of 2018. This would provide a reasonable time frame for them to determine their ability in the governor's proposal. Ottawa County further asks that the Department of Human Services be held to their financial commitment to Ottawa County. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have the next two testifiers, Anna Ashby from Catholic Charities of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Sarah Greenfield from Take Action, Minnesota. Pardon me, I have Catherine Wagoner first and Anna Ashby. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Catherine Wagoner. I work with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and I'm here on behalf of the Prosperity for All campaign, working on a $100 a month cash increase to the MFIP cash levels. I want to thank Governor Dayton for including this increase under economic stability for families in his supplemental budget. During the past couple of months, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless staff members have had the opportunity to gather over 200 stories from MFIP workers and families enrolled in MFIP across the state from places like Moorhead, Alexandria, Duluth, St. Cloud, Princeton, Wilmer. We have stories from Minneapolis and St. Paul and many surrounding suburbs like Shakopee, Apple Valley, Coon Rapids, and White Bear Lake. We asked one simple question: what $100 do, an increase of $100 do for your family? Overwhelmingly, the top five ways $100 would help families are to pay for gas or car repairs and car insurance, to pay utility bills, pay rent, to buy clothes and uniforms, and to buy food. Other notables: household items like laundry soap, emergency money to start a savings account, school supplies, diapers, medication. MFIP is a workforce development program with strict employment, volunteer, and job search hourly requirements. Parents need to be able to pay for the things that support their success in exiting the program. Thank you again to Governor Dayton for including the $100 cash increase in the supplemental budget.
Thank you. Ms. Ashby?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Anna Ashby, and I'm the public policy advocate at Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. As you know, we work with tens of thousands of clients each year, most of whom are experiencing poverty. We are grateful for the increase that the governor included in his supplemental budget for the Homeless Youth Act. Just a few weeks ago, I was able to lead a group of youth from Catholic Charities Hope Street Shelter for Homeless Youth around the Capitol to meet with their legislators. The group included youth who had never experienced support like that they have at Hope Street, youth who have never had a network so able to support them as their peers and advocates there, and youth who are sincerely grateful for the state investments that have helped change their lives. Hearing the stories of these extraordinary youth was an important reminder for me and for their lawmakers that providing support for those most in need at one of their most vulnerable moments in their youth can have a profound effect on the future of every one of those people. Along with providers statewide, Catholic Charities uses Homeless Youth Act funds as one means of supporting our work with youth who need specialized services to help them attain permanent housing stability. The Department of Human Services received millions of dollars in requests over what they were able to fund with Homeless Youth Act dollars in the last RFP, and we applaud the governor's additional investment, which will allow more excellent programs to be funded. We know that youth homelessness is a problem that, with targeted investments, we can end. As a member of the Prosperity for All Coalition, we'd also like to echo support for the Minnesota Family Investment Program cash grant increase of $100, which was included in Governor Dayton's budget. You have all heard the line that this cash grant hasn't been raised since 1986, and this means that the 30,000 families on MFIP today are unable to afford housing, transportation, diapers, and other basic needs, while on a program that, by design, is meant to help stabilize them so they're able to get back on their feet. While an increase of $100 a month would not resolve our 29-year disinvestment in low-income families, it would help the state of Minnesota take a step in the right direction in investing in two crucial building blocks of the state's future, children and families. We look forward to working with you to pass an increase for MFIT families for the first time in 29 years. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Sarah Greenfield and Nick Wilkie.
Thank you for having me. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I am the healthcare program manager at Take Action Minnesota. There's a lot to like in this budget. I'm here in support, in particular, of the governor's proposal to continue the Minnesota Care healthcare program for the working individuals and families that rely on it around the state. These are 95,000 hardworking Minnesota adults earning between $8 and $12 an hour in full-time jobs. They have precious little disposable income to spend on vacillating premiums, deductibles, and copays. For decades, Minnesota Care has led the nation in providing in giving these families access to affordable, quality health care with comprehensive benefits, including the model mental health benefits. Under the ACA, Minnesota Care was upgraded and translated into the first basic health plan in the nation, removing the hospital cap and waiting periods for enrollees. New York and other states are in hot pursuit to do the same for their residents. The governor's proposal recognizes this successful model and continues the use of the Health Care Access Fund for its intended purpose of funding this program. Counterproposals to end the Minnesota Care program would throw this population and MNSHR into chaos. And I do have a letter here signed by 83 organizations with more detail on the importance of keeping the Minnesota Care program. We'd also like to support the Governor Dayton's proposal to create and fund a healthcare financing task force. Minnesota values have helped us achieve nation-leading coverage rates, affordability, and access, but what we do with the opportunities ahead will define what healthcare means for our children. We need the people who are most directly affected by these decisions to be at the table to inform a path of health system transformation that doesn't just shift costs to consumers, but lowers costs and improves health. That's why we support the timely creation of this task force, and we've been supporting SF 1275 to create a similar body with some similar and some different duties. We hope for continued work on the language of these two proposals to set the stage for an important body of work.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. Marnie Fault, Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, taking the place of Nick Wilkie. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today representing the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and our MA reform campaign. On your behalf, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Adults with disabilities are thankful for the waiver services they receive through our state's medical assistance program because these services are essential to living independently in their communities. However, there is a hole in that medical assistance, or MA, safety net. The qualifying income, asset, and spend-down standards are too low, forcing adults and seniors with disabilities deep into poverty to get the services they need to remain independent. We are disappointed that the governor's budget does nothing to address these low qualifying standards, especially the MA spend down to 75% of the federal poverty level, or $730 per month. We do want to thank the governor for his recent public support to repeal the premium increase for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. This work incentive program is designed to allow persons with disabilities who are able to work to benefit from their earned income by paying a monthly premium for medical assistance rather than having to spend down their income to $730 per month.
Thank you.
The premium increase has placed thousands of adults with disabilities in precarious financial situations. They just can't afford the higher premiums. Current DHS data shows that 650 more persons have disenrolled than is typical for the three-month period before the increase went in place, indicating a growing crisis that should be addressed now. Persons with disabilities want to work, but must have access to the health care and supports they need to survive. Although the governor does not address the continued problem with MA qualification standards for those living with a disability or who are elderly, we urge the Senate to take steps to reform this program and not force Minnesotans into deeper poverty to qualify for health care coverage. It's been 32 years since the MA asset standard was last raised and 14 years since the qualifying income and spend-down standards were raised. MA reform is long overdue, and we are counting on you to make it a budget priority this session. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Wilkie. We now are, hello, Mr. Nelson. Please say your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM and also a member of the 5% campaign. And on behalf of 90,000 caregivers who often work 2 to 3 jobs in order to support their families, caring for older adults and people with disabilities, I'm disappointed that the governor did not include a rate increase for home and community-based services for people with disabilities and older adults. I can tell you that many thousands of people, I hope that the Minnesota Senate recognizes this need, this critical need, and addresses a rate increase in 2015. We all passionately believe in the vision of Olmsted. And critical to the success of Olmsted is a viable workforce. And a rate increase is critical to maintaining and growing and sustaining that caring workforce for people with disabilities and older adults. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And I know that this committee appreciates the work of the people that you're describing and the needs that they have. So thank you for your testimony today. Mr. Varkle, may I impose on you to wait for just a minute? Mr. Elwood is here and needs to testify here and then move forward. You can say no if you want to, and then you two can go on the hallway and fight it out.
I owe him for many Twins games, so I'll let him go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I appreciate the accommodation. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to repeat many things that folks said, but I do want to express Legal Aid's great appreciation for the governor's funding of the increase, $100 increase on MFIP. We really very much appreciate that. And equally appreciative for the removal of the Minnesota CARE proposal in the governor's office and funding the full program that is such a vital program to all of our clients to make sure that they can start to build their assets and move forward and get themselves out of poverty. And finally, we just really want to appreciate the proposal for the task force on health care financing. We think that it's wonderful that it's proposed and funded, and very, very important for the long term. So thank you very much for allowing me to jump the line and offer some comments on behalf of Legal Aid.
Thank you very much, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you.
Mr. Varkle, and following Mr. Varkle will be Twyla Brace. So if Twyla is here, would she prepare to come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the division, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. For healthcare workers, the governor's revised budget contains two pieces of very good news. First, the improved balance for the Healthcare Access Fund allowed the governor to delete his original proposal to save $65.5 million in the Minnesota Care Program. At the time, we joined several community allies in expressing deep concern over these cuts. While we understand that the deficit in the Healthcare Access Fund needed to be fixed, we did not think that the program problem should be solved by shifting costs to Minnesotans making less than 200% of the federal poverty level and adding extra charges to the sickest portion of that group. The governor said he proposed these cuts only to address the Healthcare Access Fund deficit, and by removing them from his budget, he kept his word, which we appreciate. The Senate should resist any further efforts to cut Minnesota Care or divert Healthcare Access Fund revenues to other programs. Second, we applaud the governor for investing $25 million in Minnesota's most understaffed nursing homes. I just want to take the opportunity to express our strong support for Senate File 273, the bipartisan bill, to make a far more substantial investment in a fairer, more realistic nursing home reimbursement system. Along with this good news, there's two bits of continuing areas of concern. I share Mr. Nelson's concern about our need to make a broader investment in Minnesota's seniors and disabled. We're supporters of the 5% campaign. And then finally, we have some concerns about the governor's oral health initiative. We think dental rates do need to go up for everybody, but we think we should find another source than the Critical Access Dental Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. I see Ms. Breeze has come in to the room. Please join us at the table. Introduce yourself, and then Laura Sales is next on our list, if she would approach. And then Allie Fredericks, will be up next after that. Thank you. Please introduce yourself. You do not need an introduction, but for the audio.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Twyla Braes. I'm President of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I'm here mostly to address the amendment. The amendment of A21, at line 20.13, we just want to draw the committee's attention to it. It's in a section called Rate Increase, which isn't normally where you would find information about health information exchanges, but that's what is in that section.
This is the end of the rate increase. This is on page 69. We're deep into MDH by that point.
Madam Chair, yes. Senator Lori says that it's not actually in the rate increases. So it just happens to be the large heading that's above it. So I just want to draw your attention to that. And we met with Senator Lori yesterday and asked for different language on line 20.19. And we're aware now that there is an amendment that will be coming that will include our language, making sure that the services are all detailed, both being clinical data repository, master patient index, and record locator service, so that we will protect the right of patient consent before the data is shared in that situation. And so we're glad to hear that. I just have one comment about line 20.16 to 20.18, and I was talking to the health department and didn't quite get to that point before I had to come in and testify. But we have, when we talked to Senator Lori, we understood that what the health department didn't want is that they didn't want creative ways to stop the sharing of data with the public health department from entities. And we understand why they wouldn't want that. My concern, because I hadn't seen the language before and I went looking to just see about the disease modernization, disease surveillance modernization, which happened, I think, in 2006, perhaps, is, and I just want to draw the committee's attention to this because I didn't know this until this morning. So I will give a page would like to come and find this. But there is a description of the Minnesota Electronic Surveillance Disease Surveillance System that we found in a health department document. And I would just like to draw your attention to this just so that the committee understands our concerns about the med system, which is all around a single person. It's all centralized data on a single person. And I understood that nothing was going to, the two weren't going to be connected. The health information exchange is separate from the med system, and that has been discussed. But when you look at this particular document and it says future implementation on the bottom left corner, and then you go up to the top right corner, and it lists this messaging between health information exchange and meds. So I want to draw the committee's attention to this because we were under the impression the two would not be connected, and this makes it look like the plan is in the future to make it connected. And so if that is indeed the case, then we remain concerned about the language in 20.16 to 20.18. In addition to that, I would just like to, on page 16 and 17 of the amendment on a completely different topic. This has to do with the task force for healthcare financing, and we noticed in here on line 16.31 the options that the task force is to look at options for transforming healthcare purchasing and delivery, including but not limited to expansion of value-based direct contracting with providers and other entities to reward improved health outcomes and reduced cost. And I would just like to share our organization's concern about value-based purchasing. Many people have said they don't even know how to judge the performance. An article, I think it was in the Washington Post or the Hill recently, like within the last 2 or 3 days, talking about HR2 at the federal level, talking about the MIPS merit-based performance system, and both liberals and Republicans agree that it's very difficult to even know how to judge the performance of a practitioner. And this would be judging and paying a doctor according to value. And nobody knows how to figure out what a value is of a practitioner. So I'm concerned when we put language in statute that would move in that direction. And those are our concerns, and I hope that you'll take them under consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brady, you said Republicans and liberals have concerns. What about Democrats?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden,
yes,
my mistake. Conservatives and liberals is what I meant.
Oh,
but
okay.
We could say Republicans and Democrats as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
With regard to the handout from Ms. Brays, if at some point somebody from the Department of Health could either verify that this was something they created or directly address the future implementation, it doesn't need to happen now, but at some point, if somebody from the department could come pull me away from the table, I would love to have some clarification on this.
Why not take it up right now?
Okay.
Please introduce yourself and answer the question for the senator if you can.
Oh, I didn't come up.
Oh, this is the next testifier. Is there somebody here from the Department of Health? Oh, is Diane coming in?
Okay.
Is that her?
Yes.
So, oh, I'm sorry. That was Laura Sales, I take it. Wasn't willing to answer that question. I can answer it, but
yeah.
Who was that over there?
She's Ellie.
Oh, that's Allie. Allie's not willing in there.
We're going to need a little time to look at this and confirm.
Okay,
so we'll have
great.
To come back.
We'll ask you to come back.
Madam Chair.
All right. Ms. Sales, thank you from the Minnesota Nurses Association. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
And then, Allie, you will be next. Be prepared to answer the question for the Health Department.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Laura Sales, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. We wanted to thank the governor for the changes he made to the original fiscal year 16-17 budget recommendations and for including several new items in his supplemental budget recommendations. We appreciate that the creating a sustainable Minnesota care program proposal was removed from the budget recommendations. As we've testified in committee previously, MNA supports the creation of a health care system that covers everyone and has concern about any proposal that could make maintaining health care coverage more difficult for any citizen or cause out-of-pocket expenses to go up, especially for those who can least afford it. We still have concerns about the closed children and behavioral health services proposal and the consolidated chemical dependency treatment rate change proposal. We appreciate the extension of the timeline for the closing of both the Wilmer Cabs and the care facility in Carlton in order to have more extensive community conversations and to ensure that the people in those facilities have appropriate places to move when the facilities close. Both these programs have a demonstrated need in the community and highly trained staff that are assets to those programs. The loss of these programs would be felt by both the communities and the participants. Lastly, we fully support funding for a Minnesota task force on healthcare financing. We agree that Minnesota should review and explore options to expand the current delivery system and payment reform efforts using arrangements that incentivize performance, reduce costs, and improve health outcomes. We look forward to having a task force charged with exploring healthcare policies that will continue to ensure all Minnesotans have access to high-quality, affordable healthcare. While there are still many important decisions for you and legislative leaders to make in 2015, we urge you to fight equally hard for this provision because of its importance to the health and well-being of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sales. And this is Allie Friedrichs.
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the community, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and I promise to keep it brief. My name is Allie Friedrichs, and I am the Community Health Service Director for the Meeker-McLeod-Sibley Community Health Board. I am also a member of the Local Public Health Association, which represents over 200 public health leaders from cities, counties, and tribal public health agencies across the state. We applaud the governor for increasing monthly payments for low-income families through the Minnesota Family Investment Program without taking funds from home visiting. This is an astute way to provide much-needed monthly support for families in need without sacrificing precious home visiting dollars to the detriment of public health. I apologize for not being available to testify earlier this session on LPHA's top priority, which is to restore local public health grant funding by the appropriation by $6 million per year. This grant is a core source of funding for local public health departments across the state. It gives local agencies the capacity to address ongoing and emerging local public health needs. Funding to the local public health grant was cut by 29% in 2003 in response to the state budget deficit, and it has not been restored. As a result, important programs and services have been cut, and local tax levies have increasingly carried the burden of trying to fill these gaps to ensure community health needs are met. Increasing funding to MFIB and restoring funding to the local public health grant would have a direct and positive impact on realizing the governor's goal of healthy children, healthy families, and healthy communities across the state of Minnesota. As budget bills are being assembled and moved, we ask that you continue to support MFIB increases, but also to remember to include local public health grant funding and support its restoration by increasing its funding by $6 million per year. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. At this point, if the health department is ready to respond to previous question and handout.
In the hallway.
Looks like they're still working on that.
Okay. So, Mr.
Renew my motion on the 821 amendment and stand for questions from members on that.
Any discussion? Any questions from members? Hearing none, Senator Lori moves the 821 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. The 821 amendment is adopted. Senator Lori?
I have an 822 amendment. I think
it's going to be passed out to members at this moment.
So,
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, the 822 amendment has to do with the hospital rebasing and the disproportionate share hospital formulas that were in the original governor's budget. And what this amendment does is eliminate some of the DHS factors that they aren't planning on using for the DISH adjustment. Specific numbers are still in flux, and they haven't finalized exactly how the DISH will interact with the rebasing, so we're not down entirely right now. What this language includes is extending the 5% rate bands for DRG hospitals through whatever period it takes to get to the next rebasing. It addresses the banding for the critical access hospitals. There was a 5% band, lower and upper. It keeps a 5% floor, but it removes the ceiling because we're putting some additional money into the critical access, and some of the critical access hospitals will experience much more than a 5% increase. And that is extended through the next rebasing period as well. It removes the critical access hospital DISH pool. It clarifies the DISH factors that are going to be used. It clarifies the DISH redistribution method. It also rolls the ratable adjustments into the rates that they put into the new system for all hospitals, including long-term and rehab hospitals. And it repeals language associated with the hospital payment adjustments that are no longer in use. With the new formula for DISH, the intent is to mitigate some of the effects left after the rebasing results. Members may remember we went through the rebasing, and it is a budget-neutral rebasing, which is very difficult to accomplish. In order to try to meet that budget neutrality, some of this disproportionate share hospital money is used to try to smooth out a couple of the rough edges from a budget neutral rebasing on the rates. Ultimately, there are still some hospital increases and decreases, and this continues to be a work in progress. The A22 amendment has been shared with the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I have checked with MHA, and they would like us to adopt this in order to move forward and continue the discussion. But again, I reiterate, this continues to be a work in progress. So with that, I'd move the A22 amendment and stand for questions.
Senator Lori, I have a couple questions. One is, would like the perspective of MHA. You already said that they want it to be adopted in order to move forward, but if they can elaborate on their position, that would be helpful. And then second, is there any impact on the number in the governor's budget, on the budget for?
It remains a budget-neutral item, so there is not a budget effect.
Perfect.
And we do have Mary Krinke here from MHA that can come for their perspective.
Thank you.
And probably a good line. She always is good for a good line.
Ms. Krinke, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And as you all know, the budget-neutral rebasing process has caused winners and losers and a lot of angst amongst our members, but I think this amendment does help by extending the rate bands, the plus five, minus five. And obviously, if you were one of the winners, you may not want to extend that band, but if you were one of the financial losers, you did want to extend the rate band. And our board had a thorough discussion on this and made the decision to move forward with the rate bands for a longer period of time until the next rebasing can occur. I think the rest of the language in the bill is pretty technical. I know you all may not remember this, but over the last 10 years, we have had six different rate cuts to the hospitals. And all total, they come up to about 16%. And every time there's a claim, the department has to process those individual rate cuts on every single claim. And one of the language in the bill, in this amendment, says that that's all going to be rolled now into the rates. So much of this language is fairly technical. I do believe the department is working on another DISH amendment that may not quite be as technical.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Do members have any other questions?
No good luck.
I'll save my good line for the next time.
Thank you.
But we are supportive of this amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Kinkey. Any other questions from members on the Aid 22 amendment? Senator O'Sharon?
I would just say that I appreciate the work that's being done on this. I've been here for most of those 10 years, and this has just been a real struggle to try to get this resolved because of the I think the parameters of it being budget neutral creates some winners and losers, as Ms. Krinke said, but I know that there are many hospitals that have been functioning well under what their costs are. I think they all have, but more have been suffering from very low costs. So this is really important reform to begin.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Before we move the amendment, are there any other testifiers in the public that wish to comment or provide some perspective on the amendment? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves the A22 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. The A22 amendment is adopted. Senator Lori?
The only other one I have is the 825, and that is to try to work with the information that Twyla Braze mentioned she brought forward, and I don't know if we're ready for that yet. So,
Senator Lori, I think we are.
The 824?
Maybe not. And if not, I know there's another amendment as well.
I do know of a couple of other amendments, but Senator I don't have any myself.
Do any other members have an amendment? Senator Hayden?
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A23 amendment. The A23 amendment simply changes for the CCAP program. It changes the annual eligibility or the eligibility redetermination calculation that currently is at 6. They could do it at any point, but no later than 6 months. We're changing that to 12 months. So we heard that, I think, this bill in policy. It's very helpful for those who have to redetermine and the families. So it's simply on line 3.1. If you said, see, it says often than every 6. We're striking that and moving this to 12 months. So the department has brought this forward.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. And it does have a fiscal note that I believe members are also. And it's actually from Senator Wicklund, not the department. But we do have a testifier, and Senator Lori hasn't seen the amendment yet.
Did you have the amendment? I don't have it.
He does not have the fiscal note yet.
Joan, give me the fiscal note.
So, Senator Lori, while you have a time to digest the fiscal note, can we bring a testifier? $7.3
million takes a little bit of time to digest.
I know we have one testifier, so I'll open it up for the testifier to talk about the amendment, maybe some perspective on the fiscal note as well. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Benskofer. I'm the Director of Policy and Communications at the Association for the Education of Young Children in the School Age Care Alliance. And as Senator Hayden said, this bill changes the Child Care Assistance Program's reauthorization from 6 months to 12 months. We know that families who are still eligible for assistance often lose their assistance because of a lost pay stub or they get their paperwork in a day late, and changing to 12 months will allow these children the important continuity of care that is so important for their early learning development.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from members to the testifier? Senator Lori?
We'll have to review the fiscal note. I mean, we can go ahead and put the amendment on. It's fine, but it's quite a...
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this isn't a fiscal question. We did hear this in policy, and there's some reasonableness about continuity, so I understand it's good policy. Again, $7 million is a chunk to digest. I have a question about the effective date. Why are we waiting till August 31st instead of, say, July 30th? And I'm just thinking in terms of practicality, if people have children that are school age and they decide to do care that coincides with a school year, it would make more sense to give them more time. Can somebody help me clarify as to why August 31st? Is there a fiscal impact if we change the date?
Ms. Benskofer, or if not, our fiscal analyst would also be able to answer that question.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Benson, this bill falls into a group of bills that Senator Lurie mentioned a couple of days ago, where implementation dates are being affected by the workload at minute. And if you go to page 3 of the fiscal note in the top, there's a note there of, basically saying because of the many systems projects that Minute has going on in human services, this bill couldn't be implemented until August 31st.
Senator Benson. Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's a sufficient explanation. It's disappointing, but it is a reasonable explanation for a misaligned effective date. Thank
Senator
you.
Benson, I think I remember from last conversation yesterday, Senator Lurie mentioned that we could also work with the department and with fiscal
right.
to work on that timeline if it needs to be bumped up, and it's reasonable to do so. So I think there's room to work on that.
Yep. Thank you.
Senator Lurie?
Yes, I agree. It's a new process. We're trying to accommodate it and keep the same parameters that we've always had, but we have to make the amendments in order for MMB to sign off on. But it still allows us to continue to push and ask why the implementation can't be done earlier, and if it can, then we adjust the fiscal notice and we'll get it all worked out by May 17.
With that, is there any further discussion from members or any other testifiers who would like to provide some insight at this time? If not, Senator Hayden moves the A23 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lurie.
I'm informed we are ready with the A24 amendment, which includes the language that Ms. Braze mentioned that she brought to me yesterday, which is amenable to us as long as we have a definition of master patient index. So we've included that in this as well. And I do believe it provides a great deal of additional clarity to an issue that we discussed at length in the Judiciary Committee. So I stand for questions but move the A24 amendment.
Senator Lurie moves the A24 amendments. Discussion from members. At the same time, if there are any testifiers in the public who would wish to also provide some testimony on the A24 amendment, please come up at this time. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze, President of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we are pleased that our the last part of that amendment, which is our language, which is more clarifying, is there. I'll just make one general comment about the first part of the section, and it's good to have the Master Patient Index actually identified. But the only thing that I will say is because we have wanted consent, rather consent for all of the different purposes that the health department gets information on individuals without their consent. We have wanted that consent, and so here we are solidifying that there is no consent, and I will not say that we're happy with that, but we are happy with the last part of the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Senator Lurie moves the A24 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion carries. Amendments adopted. Aye. And I was just informed that the department is ready to respond to the chart that was passed out earlier, so Diane Rydrick. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Proceed.
So I'm hoping that I understand the question correctly. I think the question was about the relationship between the MEDS database and the Health Information Exchange oversight changes and the diagram.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, specifically, this was represented as something that would have been created by the department, and if there's no indicators on there, I would like you to acknowledge this and then inform us. Thank you.
Ms. Riker?
Madam Chair, Senator, so I won't be able to speak to the details of the MEDS database itself, as that is in a different part of the department. What I can say is just a little bit about how a health information exchange works in the context of required reporting to the department. So there are certain communicable diseases that are required to be reported to the health department, some of which go into MEDS, things like TB. It goes into the MEDS database. Currently, information that is provided by usually hospitals to the health department to meet those reporting requirements, sometimes it comes in via paper, sometimes it comes in electronically, sometimes it comes in electronically using a certified provider, sometimes it does not. The federal government requires certain reporting to happen electronically. So electronic laboratory reporting is required by the federal government to happen electronically to the health department. My understanding of this diagram is that it describes the goal of the MEDS program to move to a more consistently electronic transmission of data from hospitals to the health department. When that happens, they are submitting it to us. We are not going out and querying for it. We are not reaching out for the data or using an RLS. Hospitals submit it to us to meet their reporting requirements. So nothing that is in the bill that's before you today changes our authority to access information. It does not create an ability for us to go out and query for it. It just clarifies the types of entities that are required to be certified. So it doesn't change anything about how hospitals already report required diseases to the health department.
Senator Benson?
Is this yours?
Senator
Lord?
Oh, yes. This document is from the health department, from the MEDS program.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my concern isn't specifically about the bill that's before us, but the idea that there's two-way communication between the Health Information Exchange and the med system. As part of the plan for the Department of Health, and you represented to us in your previous statement that you would not be going out and querying, but when there are two-way arrows, that means the information flows both ways, and there's nothing. It's concerning, and again, the Department of Health has been asking for more and more and more data, and that this appears to be part of the plan that the Health Information Exchange and MEDS would have interlinked communication is a concern, not necessarily related to this bill. Mm-hmm. I just want to raise the question on the record. We don't need to belabor the point. We don't need to solve it today, but the department continues to represent different things in front of this committee, and then we find documents that say the opposite, and it's not transparent. And I would appreciate messaging at the table that was more in line with what your internal documents were.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Ms. Rydrick, any further comments?
No.
Thank you. Senator Lori, I think that's all we have for your bill. I don't know if there's any more conversation on this.
I don't have anything else on this topic. I do have an amendment. Senator Lori and I have talked about it, so I'll wait for his timing. Okay. All right. And Madam Chair, I have the A15 amendment.
We'll wait to, for the amendment to be distributed.
I got a copy of it from Stacy.
Thank you.
I did.
Oh, we do have it.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, there was also a handout based on the legislative auditor's list of recommendations. Did that go out as well? If it could, it will help us walk through the amendment.
Don't believe so, Senator Benson.
I had asked a page to make copies and hoping there.
We have it back.
Yes, thank you. And Madam Chair and members, while everything's being handed out, this comes out of the legislative auditor's report on managed care organizations' administrative expenses. There were a list of recommendations, and with the help of our colleagues in the House, folks at DHS, and the plans, this amendment is in response to the list of recommendations. And so my working document was the list of recommendations, and then I created a column referring to the pages in the amendment that would correspond to that list of recommendations. Might take a little bit of work, but I think we're 70% to 80% of the way to meeting the recommendations of the legislative auditor with this amendment. And so, Madam Chair, if I could begin my walk through. I'm actually going to begin in the middle of the list of recommendations. Page 4, starting on line 26. That takes care of, on the list, bullet points be about item 3. Legislature should specify in law requirements for managed care organization subcontracts for administrative services expensed to Minnesota's public care programs. And we did put a de minimis limit. The $200,000 number might be a point of questioning as people look at this, but when you look at the large dollar amount that we're dealing with in these audits, placing some sort of floor for investigating is pretty common in audits. And we can talk about the number, but the principle is if something is immaterial and its exclusion would not mislead someone receiving the information, then the number is reasonable. And so we put $200,000 in as a floor on subcontractors. That section also deals with about bullet point number 4. In its contracts, the Department of Human Services should further specify requirements regarding subcontracts. And it gives, it must be in electronic or written form and must indicate how they relate to state public programs. That's going to require some IT work at our managed care organizations, but it is feasible. And again, the $200,000 kind of offsets some of that challenge. Continuing the section beginning on about line 4.26 would be item 5B, amend Minnesota statutes to identify by program and specify types of payments. And again, that is covered in section 4.26. I'm happy to answer questions as we go. If no one has questions, if we could move over to about line 5.1. That covers a number of sections. Let me see. Let's start with bullet point 5B. Again, subcontractor and administrative expenses, the $200,000 limit across all programs for compensation. Specifically calling out, one of the challenges the legislative auditor had was when they would ask for things like membership in social dining or spending on alcoholic beverages, it was very easy for the entities being audited to say, well, you're going to have to show us where you have the authority to do it. And so this section directly addresses, so the legislative auditor didn't have to use their power as the legislative auditor for things that seem practical that they should be able to look at. So that's where this language comes from. Continuing on section page 5 around line 5.1, again, definitions, instructions, technical guidance to line up with compliance reporting. So that's section two. Let's see. Let's jump over to page six, line 10, administrative expenses, reporting using formats designated by the commissioner. And the goal here is that the commissioner would be consistent with the Department of Commerce, Department of Health, because right now many of their reports don't line up with other regulatory entities. And so calling out at the minimum employee benefits, sales expenses, general business and office expenses, taxes, et cetera. But the language in the paragraph below that would be, let's line these up with what everybody else does and not reinvent the wheel. So as an accommodation to the people who are subject to this reporting, let's make sure it's in line with something they might already have to do. In general, members, we move this out of 62D into 56B, so it would apply to risk-bearing entities, not just managed care organizations, but our county-based purchasing plans. I should have begun with that statement. So that is a fundamental change from what the legislative auditor had looked at, but it accomplishes the goal set out by the legislature. If we continue to page 8, about line 26, let me make sure I haven't skipped anything. Page 8, line 26. I'm sorry, line 25 and continuing to 8.31. Certifying for managed care plans and our county-based purchasing plans, they have to certify that what they're reporting only covers state plan waivers and related allowable expenses. On line 8.29, I would like to make an amendment, delete the or and insert and, because in talking with DHS, I had a misunderstanding and I thought they could do either, but what they really want is an additive report, but they want them broken out. So if we could, in my drafting error, if we could delete the or and insert and, we'd like to be more comprehensive in the look at those costs. And this refers to, on your list of recommendations, it would be about bullet point 7. Continuing on to page 8, line 32, the Department of Human Services implementing ad hoc audits. And I believe this is where the fiscal cost comes in, because there would be staff required. This gives the department the authority, if something doesn't look right or if they have questions, if things are falling out of threshold, they don't need, we're giving them the special power they need to dig deeper. There's a difference between this and the House, and the fiscal note was drafted to a shall. That was the legislation I had originally introduced. We changed that to may. Ad hoc doesn't imply a structure. It leaves it up to the judgment of the person. So saying they shall use their judgment is kind of redundant. We made it a may, and I'm told it doesn't impact the fiscal note, the changes in the language in this section. So that gets us.
Senator Benson, where is that shall or that may?
And I have lost track.
Page 10, line 18.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. I haven't even gotten there. I'm still working through my bullet points. So this is bullet point 8. So that gets us through the 5s, the 6s, 7, 8. Trying to go through my bullet points. Let's go to page 10.32. Financial audits, and this was a disagreement about how the plans wanted to approach and how the legislative auditor wanted to approach, and so I reverted to the original legislative auditor's language. They have the sort of the highest standard of reporting accountability, and I'd like to keep that in place, subject to debate and evaluation. This reinstates their authority to contract with outside vendors, but it also says, if you go to line 11.6, independent third party means a vendor that is independent in accordance with government accounting standards. Remember, we had a conflict of interest issue, And there are federal standards for this. We want to make sure that no one calls into question the independence of a vendor the legislative auditor should choose to use for their audits going forward. And so we are putting in statute that as long as they are in compliance with this, the vendor's in compliance, and the legislative auditor chooses them according to these standards, they are then independent third party. I think it will make it easier for them to contract going forward. And then moving on to the last two sections, which are sort of the least substantive and most important, unfortunately. Page 15, line 4, an advisory group on administrative expenses. And I apologize, members, but simply between the time the report was released and the time we needed to take action, the level of work that would need to be done to align administrative expenses. Some background: CMS has rules for administrative expenses, MDH, DHS, and Commerce all have different rules for administrative expenses, and it leaves a lot of gray. It leaves a lot of excess reporting that may or may not need to be done. I said excess, so I presume it may not need to be done. And so if we could have an advisory group work to make the effort on for the bullet points 1 and 2 on the legislative auditor's recommendation, I think that would be the most effective way to continue the work going forward. I will note on the second legislative auditor's recommendation for the allocation of investment income, as originally drafted in the House language, the allocation was based on premiums paid, and I really questioned whether that language was the most effective way to allocate investment. And so lumping these two into that work group, again, lets us work with some detail and experts going forward instead of me sort of drafting and we hoping we get an answer. I'm happy to stand for questions. We went through this really quickly.
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, I have been working with Senator Benson a little bit. I got this last night. I was comparing it to some other language that has been floated around. I will note that the piece that she was just finishing up on the advisory group on administrative expenses, covering the first two bullets on the recommendations from the OLA, you know, probably does need a little bit of work. I actually don't see any timeline on whether they would, complete their work ever, and whether it would actually be implemented if they did complete it or anything like that. As a work in progress, I think everybody understood we weren't going to be done with this today.
And
I think this does move us forward, and I would consider the A15 a friendly amendment, but considering it a work in progress that we'd still continue to have discussions about, and it subject to change as we continue our process.
Sure. Senator Lurie and Senator Benson, I do have a couple questions, and one of them is on the advisory group. It references a special session, Chapter 1, Article 20, Section 3, so it would be helpful to learn or know who serves on this advisory group and what stakeholders would be part of it, and do we have the appropriate one? So that's one question, too, that may be needing some fleshing out, at least if you know what that reference is, you can speak to that. Senator Benson?
I did not delineate the list, and I will add that as a comment. Timeline and better delineation of group, I can work on that.
I also have a few other questions that maybe having DHS and OLA, if they have any representatives here to talk about or give their perspective on this amendment, since we are looking at the OLA recommendations. Does this amendment align in their perspective with those recommendations? Just a confirmation of that, or if everything's or have you worked on with the OLA on this amendment, Senator Benson?
And Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles was here. He had a seat by the door, and I spoke with him before he left. I spoke with Valerie, who did the original work, and they prefer their language, but they don't have fundamental problems with this. They understand that their language is in the House, and this will be part of the conversation going forward. And we did take their suggestion for change on the sourcing of the audits. We took their language exactly that empowers them on the vendors, And so I think they understand the move from the 62D to the 256B, and we're in general agreement with that. So I will not say that they are okay with this. I will say they do not object, and they are aware of everything that is here.
Benson, does the Department of Health, or DHS, excuse me, do they have any position on this amendment, Senator Lurie?
Well, and the Department of Health. I mean, the 62D stuff is actually more Department of Health than the Department of Human Services. And so it's all three entities.
Madam Chair, I did not speak to the Department of Health, but I did speak with the Department of Human Services. We mostly discussed the fiscal note, and changing the shall to may had no impact on the fiscal note. They suggested the change from or to and again, the or was based on my misunderstanding, and they clarified, and so we made that change at their request. They did not specify any other specific objections. I will not speak for them, but they did not specify other specific objections.
Senator Lurie?
And I guess also we did have the fiscal note passed out. I should make note for the record that the fiscal note passed out was drafted to a slightly different amendment. But DHS has assured us that this is still in keeping with what the A15 amendment
and one final
would cost.
One final question, Senator Benson. The impact as well to county-based purchasing plans. Have you been in discussion with them?
And Madam Benson, Chair and Senator Lurie, they were brought into this by the House amendments. They didn't realize that this was going to happen to them, and so they have been very engaged in helping get this moved forward. Again, I will not speak for them on this specific amendment, but I know of no specific objections from them.
Anyone in the audience who would like to comment or come up at this time? Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Lehman. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, which is the state association that represents the three county-based purchasing plans that were just referenced. You're right, Madam Chair. We were not in the original OLA report. And if you read it, it doesn't cite any problems or concerns about how county-based purchasing plans are using the public dollars that they're charged with administering. Nevertheless, we have been brought into this issue, as is often the case. No good deed goes unpunished, and so we're part of the discussion. And that's fine. We think it's appropriate to review how public dollars are spent. And I just have several comments on what's been happening with this amendment. We very much appreciate the work that Senator Benson and Senator Lurie have been doing in this issue. They're raising important issues and bringing up issues that we would like to see discussed. Senator Lurie had legislation earlier this session that dealt with this in a way which we strongly support and still hope can be part of the discussion in the days ahead. Just a couple of comments. On page 10.32 of the amendment, it adds another independent third-party financial audit. County-based purchasing plans and HMOs, I believe as well, I don't want to speak for our friends in the HMO community, but CBPs are currently subject to four audits by the federal government, CMS, which does two audits of CBPs. The Department of Commerce does an audit, and then there's an independent financial audit. This would add a fifth audit. The whole premise of the report was dealing with administrative costs and concerns that administrative costs are too high. It's just a little interesting that one of the solutions to the problem of high administrative costs is to add a fifth report on top of the existing four. We would suggest that folks consider, perhaps instead of adding a fifth report, that state agencies might look at the existing four reports and see if there's any individual detail missing from one of those four reports rather than starting a whole fifth report. Let me give you an example of how this works out in real life. For one of my members for economy of purchasing plans, over half of their staff are devoted to just filling out and completing reports that are required by CMS, Department of Commerce, Department of Health, Department of Human Services. Many of these reports are redundant. Many of these reports are duplicative. We would really like to see the task force or advisory group, whatever it's called at the end, really look at this issue and see if there's ways that we can reduce those. Because the impact is a county-based purchasing plan has to issue a report to either a state or federal agency every 60 minutes, 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. Again, that takes over half of the administrative staff of county-based purchasing plans. We're not opposed to transparency, but there becomes a point where I think people are being buried in the paper that transparency is creating. We want to continue to work with the authors. We appreciate Senator Benson's work, Senator Lori's work. We think this is really important. And with that, I think I'll close.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Lehman. I think this was to empower the legislative auditor to do the work that they were asked to do previously and never got to complete. And I don't see that it's annual or repetitive, so I think it would require the legislature to have them go beyond the single initial intended audit. Madam Chair and Mr. Lehman, I completely understand the administrative burden. I would be happy to work on this, but this is in direct response to the fact that the legislative auditor couldn't find what was defined as an independent third party. And so we're kind of reworking what was initially put into place. And if there's any confusion about that, I will be happy to take clarifying language on this issue.
Mr. Lehman?
I appreciate that, Senator Benson. Senator Benson, just for members' benefit, has been very open and interested in getting input from the stakeholders on this, and we appreciate her work on this.
Hearing that discussion, I'm going to assume that as being a friendly amendment, that this is something that Senator Benson and Senator Lori and all the other stakeholders will finesse as we move forward. With that, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, if I may comment, Senator Lori, if you are not pleased with the work group at the end, maybe we could do a task force.
You know, I have some language.
Senator Lori.
I'm just putting it out there. With that, Madam Chair, if there are no further questions, I would move my A15 amendment as amended.
Senator Benson moves the A15 amendment as orally amended. Any further discussion from members? Seeing none, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who oppose, no. Amendment carries. The amendment is adopted. I think that was our last amendment, unless any other members have any other amendments to propose at this time. Seeing none, Senator Lori?
Further questions, I would move that Senate File 825, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible HS finance bill.
And before that, Senator Lori, I just want to make sure there's no more public testimony before we move the bill. Seeing none, Senator Lori, on Senator Lori's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. The bill of Senate Files 825 is adopted. Laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
With that, Senator Lori, I think we're going to take a break,
a recess?
We don't
have the rest of the materials for the 10 remaining bills, so we'll take a recess. I don't know how long a recess. Should we just come back
just
after
long?
Just
get a chance to read it.
Senator Lori,
Sharon?
What materials are you waiting for, Senator Lori?
The materials for the other 10 bills that we have on the agenda.
Oh, you don't have
them. I mean, we passed out a huge packet to support this morning's efforts, and we need to kind of clear that away and bring materials for the other 10 bills, so we'll need to recess.
Senator Lori, maybe noon would work, an hour, just over an hour of recess, and then come back at noon.
Okay. I offered everybody lunch. I don't think it's ready yet. I'd like to. I'd like to.
Table.
Maybe just 30 for food, and then we would resume.
Just the committee.
Okay.
Resume at noon.
Yes.
And 11:30 for food. Thank you, members. We stand in recess.